Help me up. Thanks, Ben. Reverend Pastor Bishop, I like the promotion. Yeah. Thanks, Doug. I'm delighted to be here. The eighth year thing is a big thing to us. Last week we were here and got to hear Jason. Wow. Stacy greeted me and said, "Welcome home." And we feel like that. We feel like we're home when we're here. And obviously that's connected to Doug and Heidi, but the friends we've made here over the years are dear to us. And every year there's people from Open Door who kind of live here now, at least during the, when you ought to be here, come by, and some GCU students back there from Open Door. So I'm delighted. Our two daughters are going to be here the next service. And I promised some people at home, Caleb, Natalie, Preston, Tristan, hi, they're watching on live stream. Good to be here. I love the focus and the theme that you've chosen for Lent, the six-week journey with Jesus toward the passion of Christ, toward the cross of Christ, by considering the cross, by seeing it through the eyes, as Doug just said, of a variety of people. So we'll see the cross, I don't know all the people you've chosen, but through the eyes of people like Peter, also Judas. You'll see the eyes maybe through Pilate. That'd be an interesting thing to talk about, or the cross through the eyes of people like Herod. But today, as Doug said, we're going to see the cross and look at the cross. I think gaze at the cross a bit through the eyes of Mary. And part of why I chose Mary when Doug told me about this is because she was actually there at the cross, physically there at the cross. Significant is that, I think, at least in part, because of who wasn't there. Because Peter wasn't at the cross when Jesus was crucified, nor was Judas, nor any of the 12, save John, who was there with Mary. John, who tells us in the gospel that bears his name, John 19:25, that standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother Mary, along with his mother's sister, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. If it were a painting of this scene, the inscription I would choose would simply say, "There were some women watching." Because everyone else had gone, had left him and fled. There were some women watching, however, and one of them was Mary. So as we join Mary here at the cross with the two other women, the question I want to start for Mary is this, and it's inspired by a song we sing around Christmas. Mary, did you know? So Mary, did you know that when you said yes to the angel's invitation at the beginning of this story, some 30 years previous, to receive the life of God in you, be it done unto me is just as you said, is what you said, Mary. Did you know then what it would cost you to say that yes? How it would change you and stretch you and sometimes really scare you when you said yes? And that one day, that yes you said to the angel, and actually you said that yes to God, it would bring you to a place like this where you stand right now before the cross as you watch your son, the promise, die. Because when you first said yes, Mary, it felt really good. And it usually does. When we say yes, generally to something, it feels really good when the heart is open and tender and eager to say yes. It's easy to say yes. You know what I'm talking about. Sometimes you get coerced to say yes, but some the best ones are the ones that are, I'm really eager to say yes, and she was. But she had no idea, right, what that would mean for her, word that would bring her. She had no idea what she was saying yes to when she said yes to God. Word analogy. It was 51 years ago, at the end of this month, March 30th, 1974. Most of you were alive then. Anyway, that my wife and I, Bonnie and I, at the ripe old age of 19, she was 19, and I was 21, brilliant. Did what you do when you're young and in love and a little bit stupid, but entirely certain. We said yes. to each other. We said, I do. We said, I will. Till death do us part. And it feels really good to say yes. When your heart is open and tender and eager to say yes, it's easy to say yes. It feels really good. But we had no idea. How many of you know? That's true. We had no idea any more than you did when you said yes, if you are married. We had no idea where it would bring us, what it would cost us, how it would change us and stretch us, sometimes scare us. And it kind of makes you wonder after 51 years, would be a pesky little question, Dave, Bonnie, would you, if you knew then, when you were 19, 21, what you know now, would you say yes again? Let's ask Mary that question. So Mary, did you know what it would cost you when you said yes to God? And if you knew then when you said yes, a little bit scared, but there was an eagerness about it. If you knew then what you know now, would you still say yes? Because she had no idea what she was actually saying yes to when she said yes to God any more than you did or I did when you said yes to God or I said yes to God, particularly for the first time. Can you remember? Can it go back in your mind? This is a good thing. The first time you said yes to God, because some of you, like Mary, when you said yes to God for the very first time, were just kids. Mary was just a kid. And some of you were just that. When you first said yes to God, come into my heart, Lord Jesus, be it done unto me. I receive your life. Spend eternity with you. When I die, I was 8. When I first said yes. And guess what? I had no idea. I had no idea what I was saying yes to, but it feels really good to say yes when your heart is open and you're 8 and your heart is tender because you're 8 and you're eager to say yes. It's easy to say yes, but I had no idea any more than Mary did, any more than you did, what I was saying yes to or what you were saying yes to when we say yes to God, particularly the first time. So Mary, did you know when you said yes, be done unto me? It would begin for you a journey, and now we're on the Lenten journey. It would begin for you a journey that would one day bring you to a place you didn't want to go, to the foot of a cross, where you would watch the promise of God die in front of you. And I wonder if she remembered on that day, standing before the cross, what she heard the angel say on another day, Luke 1, verse 32, because the angel said he would be great. The son born to you will be great, the son of the most high, a ruler of the nations, a kingdom without end, some kingdom this, as she's looking at him on the cross. And yes, the resurrection's coming. We know all that is true. And when it does, every doubt will be vanquished, every fear will be gone. But Mary, did you know when you said yes to God, there would be days like this when the lights go out, when the dreams are shattered, when you don't understand what is going on, when hope seems lost, promises die? Did you know where this might bring you, what it might cost you? Was it more than you expected when you said yes? Well, much like us, I think she kind of knew. I mean, going back to the marriage analogy, I mean, if you had asked Bonnie and I when we were 21 and 19, you know, there's going to be trouble sometimes. And I would go, of course I know that. I kind of expected something to be weird because life is weird. So I think she kind of knew in a general way that this could cost her something. I mean, stretching the metaphor into a reality, she became pregnant. Pregnancy always costs you something. But she also heard, not just in a general way, but in a very cryptic way, what it might cost her to bear this child from a prophet named Simeon, Luke 2:27. Should be on the screen. Mary and Joseph had brought the baby to the temple to bring him to Simeon, the priest, actually. And it says this, and Simeon came in the spirit into the temple. And when the parents, that is Mary and Joseph, brought in the child Jesus to carry out for him the custom of the law, he took him, that is Jesus, in his arms and said, rejoicing. Like the dots are all connecting for Simeon here. Now, Lord, I can die in peace, for my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the presence of all people. For this child I hold in my hands. It's a light of revelation to the Gentiles and the glory of your people Israel, and Mary and Joseph, it says, were amazed at the things he was saying. I mean, they didn't expect him to say this. This is jaw-dropping kinds of stuff. And then Simeon, after he kind of gets done just exalting what he's got in his hands, he begins to bless Mary and Joseph. And then he gives this prophecy about the child's destiny. Verse 34 says this, "Behold, this child is appointed for the rise and fall of many in Jerusalem." Wait, the rise and the fall of many in Jerusalem, a sign to be opposed. And then he turned specifically to Mary alone and spoke an ominous word, saying to Mary, "And by the way, Mary, a sword will pierce your own soul as well," which makes it sound like the cost of her yes to the angel just went up a little bit more, and it did go up. In some tangible and real-life ways, it did go up, and I want to give you four examples of places where the sword pierces Mary's heart, and I think it's going to help us see the cross ultimately through Mary's eyes. The first event is found in Matthew chapter 2, verse 13. It's not long after Simeon's blessing of the baby when an angel, it says in verse 13, "An angel of the Lord appeared to warn them to not go back to Bethlehem, but go south to Egypt." Here's why: because Herod had gone crazy. Herod was crazy, paranoid, and hungry, power hungry, and paranoid. When Herod heard about a king, just a rumor from the Magi about a king that was born near Bethlehem, born of the Jews, the king of the Jews, he considered this new king a threat. His solution was to slaughter all the baby boys anywhere near Bethlehem, under 2 years old. It's known as the slaughter of the innocents. And according to Matthew 2:18, the weeping and anguish in Bethlehem because of the slaughter of the innocents was beyond consolation. The voice was heard in Ramah, weeping in great anguish, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be consoled because they were no more. Be Mary now. The wonder of the angel appearing and me saying yes and now getting pregnant and having the child come is a bit dim. See this through her eyes. That is the slaughter of the innocents. Grateful, I think, that they had escaped to Egypt, but horrified that others didn't. Maybe others, certainly others that she knew didn't, alone. With her thoughts, I can only imagine that she begins to wonder and then to remember the words of the angel and the prophecy of Simeon. "Blessed are you," the angel said. "You have favor with God and with man, and blessed is the fruit of your womb, Jesus." Simeon said this child would be the consolation and comfort of Israel. Instead, there are mothers in Israel beyond consolation, and a sword pierces her soul. It's a sort of confusion. What is going on? This doesn't fit the picture at all. See, if I hold in my hands, I'm thinking Mary would think, I certainly would. If I hold in my hands the fulfillment of God's promise, if I'm holding the solution to the problem of evil and sin, if Jesus is the answer, then why am I confused? Really confused. I have no clue what's going on, how this makes sense. You ever see those billboards? I drove from Minneapolis to Arizona this time. Took me several days. And these billboards come and one of them is, "Jesus is the answer." I see it all the time. Jesus, and I'm just so, what's the question? I hate those things. Anyway, if Jesus is the answer to what, why am I confused? Because I don't know the answer at all. See, I thought when I said yes to God, some of you might have too, maybe didn't verbalize this. When I was 8, I did. When I said yes to God, I thought my questions would be answered, my problems would be solved, I would be favored. And there's prosperity theologians who tell us that you're favored, and by favor, it means that you'll get really good seats at restaurants. And that's what I was expecting. Does that make you want to puke? Okay, thank you. And what about the hate? I would think Mary would think this unvarnished evil. I knew Herod was crazy, but why would he need to snuff out all this life and where are you? And all of it stirs up another question, I think. Mary, did you know that when you said yes to God, not everyone would like it? Did you know that when you said yes to God, not everyone would approve the result of it in you? Because maybe they lost control of you. I don't know. Did you know that some would actually resent the life of God in you? They would begin to be threatened by it in some way. Again, that loss of control might have something to do with it. They might even try to kill the life of God in you because you got all religious. Get rid of that. You didn't know that was coming. You just didn't know that was coming when you said yes. It felt so good. And the truth is, for Mary, she didn't know any of that, any more than some of you knew that when you said yes to God and the life of God first came to you, began to grow in you, and then began to change you in ways that not everybody might have liked, not everyone, even among some of your family and friends. I know that some have suffered this very kind of thing in their families because they don't all like it, and they don't understand that some would resent and be threatened by it, even try to kill it, and suddenly your yes to God cost more than you expected. The price just went up, and a sword pierces your soul. Second event. 12 years later, Luke chapter 12. Joseph and Mary had taken Jesus to Jerusalem. I love this story. Bring him to Jerusalem for the Passover. And I know you know the story. They're traveling with a very large group of people, and the kids are just playing off where they are. You can just picture it. Passover, everybody's, it's like a big camping trip. I'll let the kids go play. So they go play, and they leave Jerusalem without Jesus. A day and a half. Get your head around that. A day and a half before they notice. Terrified is what they are, as anyone would be, but this is worse because they lost Jesus. I'm writing this, I had a memory of when I was a kid, our family, I don't remember why, we went to New York City, and just a little kid, and we went to the Empire State Building, and we lost my brother, Steve. I couldn't find him anywhere. My parents were frantic. I was hopeful they wouldn't find him, and they did find him, but it's weird that I remember that thing, and the terror of that thing. It was worse because they lost Jesus a day and a half, and then a day and a half back, so it's 3 days. They haven't seen him, and they find him, you know, where any little 12-year-old kid would be, church. They find him in the temple. Again, you know the story. He's sitting with the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions, and the teachers were amazed at the things he was coming up with. And Mary, like a mother, though relieved, he's there. She wasn't happy, I don't think. It says in verse 48, "Son, what are you thinking?" That's my paraphrase. Actually, what she says is, "Why have you treated us this way?" As if he did it to them. "Your father and I have been anxiously looking for you." What she means is, "We're worried sick about you," as any mother would be. And his response, verse 49, a little odd, I think, to say the least. Would you get away with this if you told your mother? Because you kind of think he's going to apologize. "I'm sorry, put you out. Should have told you." Instead, he acts like he doesn't get why they're concerned, and says in verse 49, "Why is it that you're even looking for me?" Be a parent just for a second. What do you mean? Why are we looking for you? You want to smack him? If you're a mom, you might want to smack him. And he's Jesus, so you can't do that. Because we're your parents, that's why, you little Messiah. We don't follow you. We're your parents. You follow. Wait a minute. You know where I'm going, right? You follow us. Who do you think you are? God, anyway. Then he says this as if they should know. "Did you not know I had to be in my father's house? That I am now about my father's business." And when he says that, a sword, I think, pierces her heart, because now the relationship is changing. And I wonder if you even reflect on your own journey with God. There have been times when, oh, Oh, he wants more. Oh, it's going to change. He's not just a baby. He grew up. Their relationship is changing because the issue of who he really is beginning to exert itself. The fullness of what he really is all about is beginning to emerge. He's exerting his will now. I don't like that when the kid does that. He's not asking my opinion. He's not asking for permission. He's not following me anymore. He's acting like I should follow him. I liked him better when he was a baby. Remember Talladega Nights? Come to Papa. Ricky Bobby. Race car driver, played by Will Ferrell. They're at dinner about to pray, and this idiot prays to the baby Jesus, and everybody knows this, that he prayed to the baby Jesus, and he explains, I like the baby Jesus. And it's a funny little thing, and I think I know why you like the baby Jesus, because it demands nothing of you. Well, you gotta change your diapers and all that, but there's no exerting of the will. You tell the baby where to go, and when they get a little older, their job is to follow you and obey you. You don't obey them. I like the baby Jesus. The truth is, a lot of us do. I think, without knowing it, we'd never say it that way. And what it requires at some point in our journey with God is a recalibration of some kind. The first time for me, I remember I was a young adult. I don't know, late teens, somewhere in there, because I heard the stories of Jesus growing up in church. My dad was a pastor, so I heard that stuff all the time about how Jesus loves me and that he loves me special, and I loved that he loved me special, that he died on the cross just for me, that he was thinking of me, just me, when he died on the cross. Doubt it. Anyway, but the whole idea was that he's there just for me because it's, I don't know, I would have never said it, it's all about me. 1 John 4, it's the last phrase in John's epistle, and he says this to the people he's writing to, and by the way, keep yourselves from idols. A weird thing to say. What he's saying there is keep yourself from false impressions of the Christ. False perceptions of Christ. Andy Dillard speaking of this false impression thing that we've just kind of let him be a baby because we want him to be reduced some way, says this: why do people in churches seem like brainless tourists on a package tour of the absolute? Does anyone take this seriously? Does anyone have the foggiest idea what sort of power we so casually invoke? Or, as I suspect, does no one believe a word of it? Churches are like children playing on the floor with their chemistry sets, making up a batch of TNT to kill a Sunday morning. It's madness, she says, to wear ladies' hats to church. We should all be wearing crash helmets. Ushers should issue life preservers and signal flares. They should lash us to our pews, for the sleeping God may wake someday and take offense. We prefer the illusion of a safer deity, so we have pared God down to a more reasonable size and proportion, proportions that neither demand anything of us nor stir anything in us. And while it might be okay for an 8-year-old to think like that, that he's just going to be baby Jesus, at some point you hopefully grow up and begin to see that God is not here to serve me, that I'm here to serve him, because it's not all about me. It's really all about him, because this is the Father's business we're doing, not yours, Dave. And the first time that hits you, the first time that dawns on you, especially if you like the baby Jesus, even though you didn't say it that way, first time this dawns on you that he wants more, it might feel like you got pierced by a sword. And the cost of saying yes to God just got a bit higher. Third scene. 19 years later, fast forward it, 19 years, Luke 8, the ministry of Jesus has begun. He has left, and then he went to get baptized by John, but then he came back to Galilee, but he didn't go to Nazareth, so he hasn't seen his mother for quite a while. But word began to spread about him that something was going on. There was a stir about his ministry as more and more people were coming to listen to him and see him. But he, again, hadn't come home for a while. And Mary, along with Jesus' brothers, had come to be with him to kind of check up on him. But they couldn't get close to him because the crowd was so big. They were on the outside. So Mary sent word in Luke 8, verse 20. Tell Jesus, tell him your mother and your brothers are standing outside and want to see you. But he answered and said to them, again, something kind of weird, verse 21. Well, who is my mother and my brothers? Those who hear the word of God and do it. And there's a woman standing on the outskirts of that crowd who might have overheard that, who feels a sword piercing her soul. See, I understand these calls to obedience. I get them. And these calls to discipleship and obedience that he calls all of his followers to. And while it might sound harsh, it's almost as if what he's saying, however, is this, to Mary and to whoever, I love you, Mary, but there aren't any special deals, no cost reductions, no discipleship discounts simply because you're mom. It's so weird to say it like that. Or because you're the pastor, no, you still got to follow. It's like everybody else. Or because you gave a lot of money or because you have some degree, whatever, no discipleship discounts. So who is my mother and who are my brothers but those who hear? And then they do, they actually follow in the way. Good story to illustrate that, I think, is Matthew chapter 8, beginning in verse 18. Here's the scene. Jesus is with a big crowd, and the crowds are following him. They're getting bigger and bigger. But the point I want you to get is as the multitude is growing and following Jesus, it's kind of easy to follow him because all you got to do is follow the crowd. There's something going on. I'm just going to stick with the crowd and get my cues from them and just keep following that guy. But all of a sudden, they come to a place, and they're at the shore of water, and he gives orders to leave the shore and to get in the boat and follow him out into the water. And the reason, again, that's significant is because up till now, again, as I just said, it was easy to follow. You just follow the crowd. But now if you're going to follow him, it's going to be a little risky. You're going to have to leave the shore. It's a metaphor. You have to leave the shore. You have to actually leave the crowd who you've been getting your cues from and take a little bit more of a risk and get in the boat to go to the other side. And immediately it says, when Jesus said, get in the boat, verse 19, a certain scribe came to him and spoke up saying this, I will follow you wherever you go. In a boat, fine, in that, fine. I will follow you wherever you go. To which Jesus says, basically, great. So that's again my paraphrase. But just know this, Jesus says to this guy, that foxes have holes and birds have nests. And the Son of Man does not have a place to lay his head. And if you follow me, it might be like that for you. And you still want to come? The fact is, he didn't still want to come. In fact, he kind of disappears in the white space between verse 20 and 21. But then according to verse 22, some people did get in the boat and began to go to the other side. And that, indeed, Mark 4 indicates that there were a number of boats. So a number of people continued to follow Jesus, even leaving the shore and the comfort of all that. And they, I'm guessing, were feeling pretty good about following a little bit further and the decision they had made, because we are the real followers. We are the dedicated disciples who don't care about the cost. We have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back. We got in the boat, went halfway across the lake. This wonderful thing happens because that's what happens when you follow. A big storm blew them up. And they thought they were going to die. To make it worse, it looked like Jesus didn't care because he was asleep, all of which is very confusing. If you thought that following Jesus meant that everything would be easy, because we thought that if we'd follow his way and obeyed his commands, things would go well. Seas would be calm. That's why I accepted Jesus in the first place, because my life was a mess. I wanted him to fix the whole thing. But all of that means the unexpected cost of saying yes to God when the storm comes because you obeyed. All of a sudden, the price goes up for following him. It costs a little more, but it didn't stop there. with the storm, this pattern continues because a little bit later in the same gospel, Matthew 14, there's still a water scene. Jesus comes to his disciples on the water. He's walking on the water this time, and he says to Peter, get out of the boat. Okay? Which kind of makes me wonder. It's like, okay, Lord, could you make up your mind? You know, one time you're saying, get in the boat. Another time you want me to get out of the boat. So which is it? Get in the boat, get out of the boat. The answer is easy. It's not actually easy. The answer is clear. Because the answer to what do you want me to do and what do you want is everything is what I want. Absolutely everything is what I want. And when you hear that and you've never heard that or you never understood that, it might feel like a sword pierces your soul. As the cost of saying yes to God just goes up again because he wants more. Get in the boat. Get out of the boat. Just follow me. Do what I say. Follow me there. Yeah, there too. Which brings us finally to this last scene. Mary at the foot of the cross. Can we see it with her eyes? Fact is, if you imagine yourself being there with her, looking at the cross with Jesus on it, it's not hard to be moved by the scene with grief and horror as we place ourselves in that scene and see ourselves in it. Since I was a kid growing up in church, I was brought to that place of the cross, if you will, every year on Good Friday. Very vivid pictures. I remember sitting and weeping at what it had to cost him. Every time we took communion, this body, this is the body of Christ, as Doug read to us earlier, broken for you, this is the blood of Christ shed for you. The horror and grief is not hard to find as you're with Mary looking at the cross. But gratitude as well. Gratitude is in there as well because we know the rest of the story. Because we see his love on the cross and we see him as our Savior and our Lord. And we are moved to worship. But Mary was his mother. So she saw him as her son. He was her boy. That's got to be in the pot of what she saw and what she felt. And she had watched as they mocked him and spat upon him. They beat him, publicly exposed and disgraced him. Even his friends closest to him had abandoned him. So did she know that in 3 days, all of this would turn to life? You want to poke her? Mary, it's okay. He's going to be raised. Did she know that? That life would come? Well, I think we can assume that Mary had heard that at least. And very probably from Jesus. But did she believe it? Well, let's assume she did. But even if she did believe, in 3 days, he will be raised. What's in front of her face right now? Lean into this because you have things like this in your life as well. From time to time, what's right in front of her, the undeniable fact before her right now, what's most present to her in the moment is sin and the suffering and death. But not only his suffering and death, but what she was watching was all of her hopes and dreams and expectations being dashed, dying right before her eyes. An angel told me he would be king, a ruler of nations. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you. Highly favored are you. Blessed are you, and blessed is the fruit of your womb, Jesus, and a sword pierces through her soul as the cost of her yes to God just went up again. Because now she's being called to love and obey God, even when the lights go out. Even when the dreams are dashed, the hopes are shattered. But even now, she stays. Think about that. Because when Peter made his, I will not deny you promise, but did deny him. Mary made no such promise, but didn't deny him. And when all his disciples agreed with Peter that they would not flee, but they did flee, Mary made no such promise, but didn't flee. So there she was, where she wanted to be, where she had to be, at the foot of the cross, because that's where Jesus was. G. Campbell Morgan says it this way. She was helpless and hopeless, bereaved and heartbroken, but the love that had been planted in her heart could not be quenched. Even by the dashing of her dreams, though disappointed, it could not be overcome. Though over the sea of sorrow, there was no sighing wind that said, "The dawn is coming." She loved him still. Jesus was the magnet of her soul, and he held her to himself like the sun holds the planets in its orbit, even in his death, even when the lights went out and she couldn't see the glory, even then, "Be it done unto me." I would do it again. Even then, even if it means that a sword will pierce my soul, I still say yes. And so we begin this week the Lenten journey, looking at where it will bring us to the cross, seeing it through the eyes first of Mary. But let me ask you a question as Josh kind of sings over us and invites us to ponder this ourselves. Forget about Mary for a second. What do you see? What do you see when you see the cross? It's important to look at the cross and to stay. Don't go to the resurrection too soon. What do you see?